This is Ozarks at Large. The popular image of a pirate is often a swashbuckling, bearded character seeking riches at sea. Whether Errol Flynn or Johnny Depp, the pirate has been portrayed as an anti-hero with little regard to authority. Turns out, real pirates did operate outside, usually the reach of governments. Chris Lane teaches history at Tulane University and is a preeminent historian when it comes to colonial Latin American history. He recently came to the University of Arkansas to deliver a guest lecture, and during his time here, he also came to our studio.
Piracy is as old as shipping, and the Greek word piratis is where we get pirate, and it essentially was a word for bandit as well, but it came to be attached to sea bandits specifically over time. And certainly there was wealth traveling around the Mediterranean, wealth traveling across the Indian Ocean. But after the discovery of the Americas or the encounter of the Americas with Europe and with Africa, the exploitation of mineral wealth was greatly expanded, so exponentially expanded. So the attraction for pirates became almost irresistible, I would say.
What this exploration of this world that Europeans had not seen before, maybe literally an embarrassment of riches, right? I mean,
yes, I think it's fair to say that. I mean, indigenous folks used emeralds, they used gold, they used silver for ornamentation and for religious objects and so forth. Very few instances that we know of those items being gold or silver being used as currency or of gemstones being used as currency. Certain shells, some types of beads like wampum in the Northeast could be used as a sort of currency. But the monetized economies of Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East, and of course China, India, these were economies that could absorb extraordinary amounts of gold and silver into their economies, and that was the windfall for the Spanish initially.
So this was just an explosion of currency.
Yes,
I mean this unbelievable addition of unknown amounts of gold and silver.
Yeah, it essentially overnight transformed a global economy that was predominantly an economy in kind. So where exchanges. For example, in China, tribute was paid in rice or in cloth or some other commodity that you could produce either in farming or at home. And taxes were very quickly shifted to money. So the silver economy became the kind of global standard. And troops also demanded to be paid in silver coin rather than in promissory notes or some other thing. So the expansion of the silver economy is also the expansion of gunpowder empires. We link these two things together, kind of a growth in global arms trade and in the really transformation of military operations worldwide.
Spain, then later Portugal,
yes,
start to benefit. And was there a papal decree that kind of halved up the, quote, New World?
Yes. It was formalized with the Treaty of Tordesillas in 1494. It was a papal decree that essentially gave everything east of a line running 370 leagues west of the Cape Verdes or the Canaries. There are two versions of this. But it essentially, from the mouth of the Amazon, if you ran a line south to the mouth of the River Plate near Buenos Aires, you'd have the line of Tordesillas. So Brazil fell within the Portuguese sphere. Everything to the east of that line was the Portuguese sphere of influence, and everything west of that fell to Spain. And the real dispute ended up being the Philippines, because the Spanish had a claim to the Philippines since they had sent an expedition there in the 1520s before the Portuguese had reached that site.
And it's Spain and Portugal mainly because they have the best navies and they have done the exploration?
It's a good question. This is an era before formal navies. These are essentially rather like early corsairing or pirate voyages. They're joint capital operations where a couple of wealthy merchants perhaps with some crown backing, maybe a bit of money put in by the crown. As in the case of the Columbus voyages, there was some royal investment, but that was quite rare. Ordinarily, these were private enterprises that had some sort of royal sanction or some royal license. And when these individuals went abroad, they would seek to, in the case of the Portuguese, try to get around the tip of Africa, knowing that they'd get a prize from the king when they got back. So the money going into it was rarely royal sponsorship in the direct sense, but there's a lot of after-the-fact recognition. So the empire is really not – both the Spanish and Portuguese empires, overseas empires, are really built by private enterprise with the crown coming in afterwards and formalizing the arrangement. So the conquistadors are very similar. They're self-financed, but they seek a monopoly license on trade or control of a given region after they prove to the king that they can pull off the big heist, as it were.
So I've got to imagine that the rest of Europe – was not entirely pleased with this new land of riches being split between two countries.
Absolutely not. The French, this is before the Protestant Reformation, so most everyone is at least claiming to be Catholic, but not wanting to trust the Pope on this one.
He was funny how that works when it comes to money, right?
He was a Spanish Pope, so he was likely to rule in their favor. So the King of France, Francis I, said something, or is said to have said something like, where was it in Adam's will that the Spanish and Portuguese got the world divided between them? So the French are the first corsairs, actually, the French under Catholic sponsorship. But again, private enterprise, really, in small cities, Rouen, Bordeaux, La Rochelle, Dieppe, Nantes, mariners, essentially, seafaring folk, start to prey on vessels coming back from the Americas. And Columbus, on I think his third voyage, is already facing pirates and their French corsairs. Corsairing is one way of showing your disinterest in the Pope's decree.
So would there be – were there strategies for the pirates, the corsairs, to
yes.
intercept?
Their main aim, of course, is to go after liquid treasure. So ideally – they would like to capture gold, silver, gemstones, things that they could dispose of quickly. But in lieu of that, they would capture slave ships. They would capture vessels carrying dyewood, vessels carrying sugar or cloth, or in rare instances, ransomable personages. But that was really the strategy of the corsairs of North Africa. And Mediterranean corsairing in this period, piracy broadly speaking, but the term corsair is the contemporary one. At that time, people said, oh, he's a corsair. Mm-hmm. Corsario, the Spanish would say. And corso was the kind of war of corsairing. And that was in the Mediterranean, certainly people tried to capture vessels with treasure aboard, but more often they would capture people that could be held for ransom. And a way to avoid getting caught would be to pay an extortion fee in advance, so a kind of mafia-like operation where you pay the corsairs of Algiers.
Protection.
Yes, exactly. So corsairing in the Mediterranean is an extortion and kidnapping racket, and that's how it operated essentially. And those who were captured and not ransomed could be made galley slaves. So the vessels themselves would be powered by enslaved captives from abroad. The Atlantic piracy that develops is really much more of an open sea, long distance focus on liquid capital, really grabbing those treasure ships or ships that might – or towns that could be ransomed. So what often the French corsairs would do, if they couldn't capture a ship coming back from Spain with treasure aboard – because they learned quickly to travel in convoys. So the Spanish,
right.
You know, they get wise. They realize if we travel in convoys and we arm several of those vessels, then it'll be harder for these corsairs to capture us unless they can put together a fleet. So what the corsairs would do is try to catch straggling ships maybe going through the Florida Straits. And in lieu of that, they would go to Havana or Cartagena, which in this era were very small towns. They weren't big cities yet. And hold the town for ransom, essentially pull up alongside the town or come into the bay and say, we're going to blast the town hall unless you give us some money. So they forced the Spanish to wall and enclose those towns, and even to abandon quite a few towns that couldn't be adequately defended. The next bunch of pirates that come along are the Elizabethan English pirates. And there's an ongoing war between Spain and England, but even during peacetime, corsairing continues. So Francis Drake is probably the most famous of the corsairs of that period. And he's certainly a Protestant who sees no love for Catholic Spain. But he begins as a slave trader. He and a cousin, John Hawkins, they're West Country Englishmen who are putting together these corsairing voyages in the English Channel, but they see a possibility to penetrate the Spanish-American slave trade. So they go – this is something that the Portuguese by this time had taken over. They go into West Africa and actually capture Africans from villages and put them aboard their ships and take them to the coast of Venezuela and what's today Colombia and try to force local people to buy the slaves. Now, locals know that they're not supposed to purchase slaves from Englishmen because that's contraband, that the contract is held by the Portuguese and slaves are supposed to be sold only in official ports of entry and so forth. But Drake and his companions do manage to sell slaves in a couple of voyages in the 1560s. They do quickly discover that you can't go back to the same villages in Africa and capture people. They're ready for you the next time. So
you have to find new places.
And what they discover is that the Portuguese had already figured out that you need to trade for captives taken in wars in the interior, try to make friends with people in one place and say, are there enemies of yours that have produced captives. But that transformation in slave trading is pretty quick. The Elizabethan corsairs, Drake and Hawkins, come back in 1568, and the Spanish are ready for them in the Caribbean. They essentially say, no, you can't sell any of those slaves. And the colonists say, no, we can't purchase any of those slaves or we'll lose our heads. And so many of the slaves suffer. Many of them die. Ultimately, the ships try to exit the Gulf of Mexico and get caught in a storm, a nor'easter, that pushes them back into the Gulf. And they stop at Veracruz, the port of Mexico, on the Atlantic side. And the old law of the sea is if you have a tattered ship and you've suffered in wrecks and so forth, or you're in danger of losing all hands, that even an enemy port should give you a chance to refit your ships and be on your way. So they were taking advantage of that law, and they were given a time to try to fix their vessels. While they were there, the new viceroy of Mexico arrived with a fleet and was outraged that pirates were refitting ships. As far as he could see, the English contraband traders, who also were known for their pirate activity, that they were refitting in his port. So he and his vessels fired on the English, who then tried to escape, and most of the vessels were destroyed. But Drake and Hawkins did make it back to England separately, limping back.
Right.
But angry as hell. They were extremely upset, and Drake then basically devoted the rest of his life to singeing the King of Spain's beard, as he put it.
The idea many of us have about pirates, if we heard that term, are these sort of free agents who are only in it for themselves, to get rich themselves. But many of the corsairs had official or unofficial backing, right?
Yes. Yeah. The definition of a corsair, the term later becomes privateer. So in the 18th century, you hear the word privateer. All that means is that you're engaging in an act of piratical seizure of somebody, some private person's goods or a vessel at sea, but you're doing it with a license, a letter of marque and reprisal. So the kind of the medieval law of the sea was no one really can control the sea. No one can claim sovereignty over the sea. So at sea, it's catch as catch can. So what's best is to have a kind of floating castle with high walls on it and cannons bristling all around to show that you can't be easily taken. But it's this sort of castle at sea mentality, my castle against your castle. And if you fall to mine, well, that's just too bad. But if that should happen and I survive, then I should seek from my monarch or my sovereign a letter of marque and reprisal so that next time I go out, if I see a ship flying the same flag as the one that had taken mine, that's fair game for me. So it's got an eye for an eye sort of understanding. Now, the Spanish and Portuguese, after the Treaty of Tordesillas, tried to argue that, no, these are our waterways. We're essentially establishing seaways in which it's really only legal for us to sail and trade and so forth, and other Europeans challenging that said, no, that's hooey. And in wars between these states, letters of mark and reprisal just flew.
Finally, how did your interest in this period of history begin?
I grew up in Colorado. And
there's going to be more.
Okay. I was always interested, though, in the Spanish conquistadors and the search through the Southwest for the seven cities of Cibola and all of those stories. That was, to me, the most exciting thing about the western part of the United States. Like, Colorado means red, you know, or reddish color or something like that. So the notion of that land having some romantic treasure hunters in its past got me excited, and I continued to move south, first to Mexico and then to the Andes, and more recently to Brazil and Argentina.
And still, now you're at Tulane, New Orleans. Not a bad place.
This is a great place to be a historian of Latin America. That's absolutely true. It had its Spanish period and its French period, and it's still very exciting.
Is there any where people can go on the web to find out more about your work? Or
I'm on the Tulane University website, both under Latin American Studies and under History.
Chris Lane, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here, Kyle.
Chris Lane is a professor at Tulane University and recently delivered a guest lecture at the University of Arkansas, sponsored by the African and African American Studies, the History Department, Latin American Studies, the Multicultural Center, and Phi Alpha Theta, all at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Gentry. Big holiday tradition at KUAF, the Jonathan Winters A Christmas Carol, returns this year. It's a public radio tradition, not just at KUAF. It's hosted by NPR's Susan Stamberg. The master comedian Jonathan Winters presents a truly distinctive reading of Dickens' holiday classic with a special performing edition prepared by Dickens for the presentations that Charles Dickens himself did. It also features Mimi Kennedy. It's from NPR and KCRW. A Jonathan Winters Christmas Carol returns to the KUAF airwaves on the 24th. That's a week from today, Christmas Eve Day, at 11 that morning. A week from today at 11 a.m. Bentonville High School's Amnesty International Group is organizing a community donation event at Bentonville High School for December 20th and 21st. That's Thursday and Friday. You can donate non-perishable foods, coats, blankets, scarves, and other necessities for the cold weather. You can donate at 1801 Southeast J Street in Bentonville. And the Hobbs Conservation Area, offering a unique hands-on astronomy workshop Friday night beginning at 6:30 at the Parks Visitor Center on Highway 12, just east of the Highway 12 War Eagle Road intersection. Participants will build their own full-scale working model of the telescope used by Galileo about 400 years ago. Easy-to-understand workshop. They promise it'll be taught by Stuart Riley, a Ph.D. of Physics in Astronomy. For cost and a list of needed items, 789-5000. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Antoinette Grajeda will join me tomorrow for a brand new edition of Ozarks at Large featuring Ryan Fort, University of Arkansas graduate, Rogers native. Now he lives in Colorado, but he was back for the holidays and talking about his music, including his brand new CD. Ryan Fort and much more on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large on KUAF. You can listen to this show or any show, again, by the way, online at ozarksatlarge.com. Have a pleasant Monday.